Our lead-off speaker is no stranger to the policymakers conferences, Dr. Tony Cordesman, the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's really become a fixture. I think he's spoken at perhaps all 17 conferences. We're not quite sure. He's an expert in every sense of the word, an informed analyst who is devoted to examining in detail the Middle East military security climate. And we're most pleased that he's back with us again today. Tony?
Well, we seem to be in one of those moments where the computer never quite wants to cooperate. But ladies and gentlemen, I apologize for the use of PowerPoint. But when we are talking about U.S. and Gulf military cooperation, it is frighteningly easy to talk in terms of slogans, concepts, and simplifications. And we've been doing that, basically, with the Gulf Cooperation Council since 1980. And at the end of it, there has been an amazing amount of expenditure and an amazing lack of integration, interoperability, and effectiveness. Now, we do face an evolving range of threats. I'm not going to read you any of these PowerPoints, but let me say that the goal here, obviously, is to avoid military action. It is to combine diplomacy, deterrence, and defense on the part of the Gulf states, the United States, and create a structure which can avoid conflict, which can move forward, which can allow the region to develop rather than simply devolve into preventive or preemptive conflicts or repetitions of what we are going through in Iraq. This is not something simple, but there is a point I really want to raise. When I go out to the Gulf, when I talk to people in the region, again and again, there is a discussion of Iran as if it was some kind of hegemon. If Iran is emerging in military terms, it is not because of Iranian strength. It is because the lack of progress, cooperation, focus, and effective resources by the individual Gulf states. I have watched people in the GCC military now for more than 20 years set the right priorities. I watched U.S. commanders focus on the right goals. But the results, while they have often been a steady improvement in the military capabilities of individual states, have not been to create, in effect, Gulf Cooperation Council or to create the climate where the role of the United States and outside powers can be minimized and the role of the Gulf can be strengthened. For those of you who can't see this slide, it covers 10 years of military expenditures in the Gulf. During that period, the Gulf spent over $400 billion on military forces, and Iran spent $55 billion. The Gulf Cooperation Council, even without the United States, is spending 7.5 times as much on military forces. And it should, in the process, be able to get very high levels of effectiveness and create the basis for a very strong deterrence and defense without high levels of dependence on the U.S. for many scenarios. If we look at arms sales, the figures are far more impressive. Over the period from 1988 to 2007, the Gulf Cooperation Council states spent more than 15 times as much on imports as Iran. And while people talk about Iranian arms production, the numbers and the quality of what Iran produces as lead systems are little more than a military joke. And what you are watching in terms of the Gulf, in the southern Gulf, is access to the most advanced arms and military technology in the world, most of which has been denied to Iran. There are land force threats. But at this point in time, unless Iraq somehow comes under Iranian influence, a scenario for future meetings, John, since it seems remarkably improbable as something for the immediate future, the fact is that Iran has only one advantage, that's manpower. In terms of armor, the Gulf states have far more armor than Iran. In terms of tanks, Iran is a tank-heavy army, but it's a force of obsolete tanks, and the Gulf states have far more in terms of advanced tanks. And this ignores the ability of the United States to steadily improve its deployability of land forces. In the air theater, certainly Iran cannot be dismissed, particularly in terms of missile threats. But if you look at Iran, Saudi Arabia alone has a vast lead in high-quality aircraft over Iran. If the entire Gulf Cooperation Council is included and you look at advanced aircraft, it's a lead of around, again, 15 to 1. If you can explain to me how that makes Iran into a military hegemon, I would certainly like to hear it. It would be a very good way to get an article. Naval forces, many of the ships you see here for Iran date back to the times when I was Iran under Ambassador Helms in the early 70s. It's nice to have companions in the process of aging, but to see them as a military threat requires a great deal of caution. I would not dismiss Iran's submarines, its missile boats, its asymmetric capabilities, but this is not a modern Navy, and it certainly does not compare with the modernization of the southern Gulf states. The problem, quite frankly, is not the Iranian threat to the GCC or the US or British or French role in the Gulf. The primary threat the Gulf Cooperation Council faces is the Gulf Cooperation Council. It is the lack of effective coordination, interoperability, mission priorities, and these are not a lack of military advice or expertise within the Gulf. Perhaps in the 70s you could say that you were not talking about advanced, well-educated military leaderships. You can't say that in the Gulf today. And you can't say it in terms of the advice. None of these points today are being acted on with the effectiveness, the coherence, and the cooperation that is needed. In every area, if they were, the level of deterrence and defense against Iran, the pressure on Iran to negotiate, the level of Gulf dependence on the United States could be sharply reduced. Now, this is a briefing on the web, and asymmetric warfare is complex, it's difficult semantically. I'm not going to read you view graphs. But these are real cases. This is not a matter of misunderstanding or dialogue or communication or the fact that perfectly rational bargainers on all sides do not meet with each other. This is a fact that military force gets used, it has been used, it is a threat, and it is a growing threat as a result of Iranian actions. That is not simply the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, it is the Quds Force, it is the use of the Vivak and a group of proxies and non-state actors. Now, we often hear the phrase, closing the Gulf. I think this is a worst case and a dangerous one. The problem is that what Iran can do is conduct long-term wars of attrition at almost any level against almost any kind of target in the Gulf, with steadily improving anti-ship capabilities, abilities to attack coastal targets, and abilities to attack offshore targets. That, along with investments in long-range missiles and nuclear systems, is where Iranian money is going. That is what you need to deter, and that is what you need to defend against. And you have to do it through the entire Gulf. The constant focus on the Strait of Hormuz ignores the vulnerabilities of Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, most of the UAE. And these are matters of minutes in terms of anti-ship missiles and minutes in terms of strike aircraft. It is also obvious that no country can defend itself. This coast is a Gulf coast. It is a coast with the Gulf Cooperation Council. Nations that do not have interoperable and integrated forces are throwing their money into the desert or into the water. They are wasting and have wasted perhaps half or more of the sums that I showed you earlier because of a lack of effective movement forward. And yes, the Strait of Hormuz, the Gulf of Oman, the Indian Ocean are vulnerable, and they are areas which are more than a matter of oil exports. They are a matter of Gulf imports. Let me also note the unique vulnerability of the GCC states. We think in the United States in oil terms, the Gulf needs to think in terms of water. 7 to 9 desalination plants basically make the Gulf survive. That 7 to 9 target complexes, which Iran perfectly understands, and where commercial satellite photos will show you how weak the defense structures are at even the most basic levels. The nuclear programs, this is complex. Many of you have been trapped in reading about the NIE. Few people, even in journalism, and even many experts, never read the entire reports of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And so what we often have is strategic illiteracy in dealing with Iranian efforts. I've tried to visualize this in ways people can understand, and it isn't a matter of maps and bases. Let me show you one Iranian facility, the key facility where they're putting the centrifuges. You may never have seen a satellite photo, but this is like the entrance to the Reagan parking lot. It's actually smaller. That is how they helped conceal the facility, because look at what it was like when they finished that facility. You'll notice the dummy building. And unlike Iraq, take a look at this from the road. This is a facility where you can put over 50,000 centrifuges. You do not go to this level of concealment and hardening out of an altruistic interest to fund your electric power structures. And it is time to get real about this threat. We saw it start under the Shah. We documented illegal arms imports, or I should say technology imports under the Shah, and the process goes on. We're talking about long-range missiles. And while people often focus on Israel and Europe, something to remember about missiles is they have range payloads. You build large missiles because you may initially have large nuclear weapons, and you need them to cover targets in the region, not remote targets or rationales for U.S. missile defense. And let me note, it is my guess that we will have to live with Iran's nuclear weapons and with nuclear-armed missiles. But what people often forget are the lessons of the Cold War, a country that wishes to take risks, and in fact, a country that wants to avoid risks, can deploy missiles with systems that launch on warning or launch under attack. Once this force is deployed, the problem of deterrence becomes critical. The U.S. can offer extended deterrence as it did to Europe, but ultimately you're going to need some form of missile defense and missile cooperation. Again, this is not the time to lecture all of you on the details of military cooperation, but I'm going to give you some checklists. And I'm also going to say quite bluntly There is not one useful piece of paper that has ever come out of the Gulf Cooperation Council that describes tangible progress in any of these areas. There is not a single sales pitch that I have seen by any defense contractor that explains how this should be done. I know that these recommendations have been made within the GCC headquarters. I know they have been made by U.S. military commanders. So I'm not giving you ideas that somehow have sprung from me. These are priorities which in general have more than a decade of support by both the Gulf military and by the U.S. military, and which need action. Again, mission focus, interoperability, realistic large-scale exercises, a focus on jointness, five-year plans that bring people towards integration and interoperability, these are mechanisms. The tools apply to given kinds of war. It is not a matter of buying more arms in most cases. It is a matter of using arms wisely with the integration, with the training, with the manpower quality, and above all, the unity that's needed. We can provide technology, Britain can provide technology, France can provide technology. We can keep a technical edge as well as a resource edge if the Gulf states use this wisely. And the same tools can be applied to areas like asymmetric warfare, and at least as long as we are dealing with a rational opponent in Iran, to reinforcing deterrence and defense against Iran's use of weapons of mass destruction. Let me make a last point about this. Yes, missile defense, cooperation and counterterrorism, where frankly I think the Gulf has done well on an individual level. Certainly countries like Saudi Arabia have demonstrated they have lessons to teach us. But if we're going to move forward here, what we really need is to stop thinking this in terms of national secrets, national defense programs, arms buy, which is where the key point is often the glitter factor, something different, something expensive, something better than anybody else. What we need are credible defense plans, transparency, clear plans for cooperation on the part of Arab states, because it is cooperation within the Gulf states, not between the United States and individual Gulf countries, that is the key. And quite frankly, it is transparency and public accountability. There is no reason, in terms of security, not to make these defense plans public. There is no reason that states cannot provide the same level of financial detail and the same explanations for arms buys that they provide for buying schools or roads or desalination plants. There is no excuse for what selling countries do today, and it is countries, not contractors, that deserve the blame. There is no excuse for what buying countries do. The next step in cooperation will only occur if we get credibility, effectiveness, and transparency. Thank you.